We're now in the heart of the retreat, pretty much. No point leaving now. Might as well sit it out. We made it this far. Kisa and I won't leave. Always feel like leaving. Sometimes a day or two into the retreat. Still manage to be here. And if we can manage to be here, you can manage to be here. I wanted to, first of all, just reflect a little bit around the way of relating to teachings and practices. When Ajahn Chah, our teacher, would speak, he would often finish his talks by saying, whatever is useful for you to pick up and use, and whatever's not, leave it where it is. And I think ultimately the question is not necessarily what's exactly the right practice, what's exactly the right way of presenting teachings, what's the right form. But perhaps a better question is, what's useful? What can I use? What helps me at this particular point in my journey? And so when we present things here in this retreat, we're very aware that people have come from different perspectives, different ways. We've come from a certain kind of perspective in a certain way and using certain forms. Which may or may not resonate. And that's absolutely fine. I think it's natural that some things will resonate, some people will like some aspects of what we do, some won't. And so it's for each of us to discern what is useful and to leave the rest in the same way as if we were presented with a table of food. We might not have to eat everything. Everything may not agree with us, and so we just take what we need for our nourishment. If we can keep that perspective, it can help us negotiate the very complex and sometimes quite confusing territory of teaching and practices that are presented to us. Doesn't mean to say that we have to reject everything because it doesn't initially fit our experience. Doesn't mean to say that we have to accept everything, but to find a middle way where we explore, where we taste, where we try, and then discern. Should I pick this up or should I leave it? And the other reflection in terms of just using a retreat model, the model of a retreat, to also find our own way. The other day, Kitty Sarah was talking about this analogy with the lute, the stringed instrument. If it's too tight, we don't get a sound. If it's too loose, we don't get a sound. There's no harmony. And in a way, picking up a form, a vehicle like a retreat is like picking up an instrument, and we're learning to tune it for ourselves. Sometimes when we're working with intensity, as a retreat can bring up, we need to know how to move in and out of that, so we don't feel that all the time we're just being with painful body, painful emotions. If it becomes too demanding, we can get quite tired or quite weary. And so it's useful to know that we can pick up a way of practice to meet our experience, to engage it, but then also to know sometimes it's useful just to put it down, to relax, to allow the mind to disengage, to take a walk, to rest, to come back. And so we can get this feeling of something that is continual, but also easeful. And otherwise, these retreats can sometimes turn into something that feels like a work camp. crisis or a military operation. You feel very, very compelled to have to force the issue. There's a lot about the way of practice that unfolds in its own time, the fruit, the dropping away of the obstructions, the hindrances, the fruits of the path. A lot of that is according to its own nature, not something we can force. We reflected this morning about the way that the Buddha laid out his teaching, not stopping at just attaining refined states of consciousness, not stopping at just states of peacefulness, but to really look more into the heart of that which generates experiences of stress, or pain, or suffering, that which generates delusion in the mind. In his early practices, the Buddha to be, wasn't a Buddha yet, practiced a lot with teachers that taught how to attain to great states of concentration, to very, very refined states of mind, called states of neither perception nor non-perception, infinite space, being able to enter into these realms that were formless, peaceful, subtle, extremely, extremely subtle. But then, through his own experience, he began to find that these were, however refined the experience, the meditative experience was, he would always come down. It would always be this the impermanence of the state. It wasn't really a true release of the heart. It was always the fear, perhaps, underneath the anxiety, with the peaceful state that it was going to change, be interrupted. And so his interest began to turn to what is there a place, is there a dimension of being that is not dependent on whether the experience is refined or coarse, whether it's pleasing or unpleasing. All of this is subject to change. Is there anything that transcends change, transcends the world of change? On the night of Buddha's awakening, it said that he was able, through this practice of mindfulness of breathing, he was able to enter into all these jhanic absorptions, these very subtle and refined states of mind, going through each one, each stage. And then when his mind was very, very collected, very, very focused, was able to turn his attention to this fundamental question of the avijja, or the ignorance of the heart. What is it that generates this feeling of perpetual suffering, this imprisonment that was being talked about earlier? What is this identification with the world of form? Is there any relief? And it was through his insight that he realized what's called nirvana, or nirvana, that which transcends the world of change, that which is peaceful, changeless. But it was a subtle insight, and an insight that at first he was very reluctant to communicate because he felt it was a hard insight to communicate. It was a hard thing to transmit. And so at first there was a reluctance. In fact, he decided he wouldn't teach, he wouldn't try and communicate his insight because he felt no one would understand it. And his preference at first was just to go off and enjoy the bliss of his emancipation, his liberation. But it said that a great heavenly being, Parama Sahampati, came down from the angelic realms and knelt before the Buddha with his hands in Anjali and said, please, there are those with a little dust in their eyes. For those, please turn the wheel of the Dharma, transmit the teaching. This is a symbol or the archetype for compassion, the Buddha taught, because there was compassion. He felt compassion for the suffering of the world. And he felt there would be those, there are those with a little dust, there are those that could see, that aren't completely obstructed. Therefore, if there's a possibility, there should be a way of trying to communicate. And as it turned out, he was right. It was very difficult to teach, actually. 40 years or so he did teach, and it wasn't all a bundle of joy. There were lots and lots of hassles, lots of challenges, people trying to kill him, people trying to discredit him, schisms in the order, conflicts, fights. He even had some teachings that were complete failures. He had some of his disciples taking their life, wasn't the intention of the teaching. He had others that misunderstood him, others trying to take over the order, and on. So the whole, his whole experience wasn't easy by any means. However, this is a way, an archetype for the movement of expressing all of us in our own ways, to whatever degree of awakeness or clarity of mindfulness we have. There's a certain onus to try and live it or express it, and to expect that it won't be necessarily easy. It's a challenge. He had, it said on the night of his enlightenment, as he sat under the Bodhi tree on the Vajra seat, it said that it's the only place on earth that can handle the enlightenment of a Buddha, this particular place. If you ever go to Bihar, the most difficult place on earth, full of, well, maybe at the time of the Buddha it wasn't, but now it's, I remember we stayed with a Vietnamese monk there, and who'd been trying to build a temple for years, and so many hassles, being ripped off right, left, and center. And he just said, no wonder the Buddha was enlightened here, it's the most difficult place on earth. It's not necessarily being enlightened in the heavenly realm, but it's the difficult places where we can get spurred on to awaken. It said on the night of his enlightenment that he was able to have, he had his extraordinary ability to see into so many realms, to see so many, all of his, as it said, all of his past lives, his lives of all the different beings, the way karma would turn, the wheel of becoming, giving rise to beings arising in various states, in various situations, in various conditions, according to their karma, the dissolving of those beings. He had heavenly divine eye, had amazing ability to have psychic powers and insight. But ultimately, when he tried to find a way of articulating his teaching, to find something that was really important, it wasn't these things that he emphasized. These weren't things that they were mentioned, but they weren't that important, actually, ultimately. What he emphasized, he said, my knowledge one day to a group of disciples, he was standing in a forest, and he said, my knowledge is like all the leaves on this tree. The knowledge of a Buddha is fast. And then he picked a few leaves, and he said, but what's important is like just this handful of leaves. The knowledge I'm going to communicate to you is all that you need. It's really compared to this handful of leaves. It's essential. But it's not the whole code. We don't need to understand the whole cosmos. We don't need to have the eyes of the gods. We can't, human beings. We're not given to see the whole thing, the whole picture. But what we can, the knowledge of the Buddhas, what they transmit, is the knowledge to free the heart, human heart, from delusion and from suffering. This is the knowledge that we can pick up and use. This core knowledge is called the Four Noble Truths. and something I want to reflect on tonight, because it's really the essential teaching that the Buddha communicated. And if there's any teaching to understand, this one is that we want to apply ourselves to, this is the most essential one. This is a teaching that makes sense when we really begin to feel the weariness of being in states of unsatisfactoriness and states of suffering. And we really want to turn the question into, as was tonight in the questions, is there any escape? Is there any way out? This is a teaching that's useful to contemplate. Because we've been turning for so long into different states of being, not finding our true home, the Buddha talked about it like this. Which do you think is more? The flood of tears which, weeping and wailing, you have shed upon this long way, hurrying and hastening through this round of rebirth, united with the undesired, separated from the desired. This, or the waters of the four great oceans. Long have you suffered the death of father and mother, of sons, daughters, brothers, and sisters. And whilst you are thus suffering, you have indeed shed more tears upon this long way than there is water in the four oceans. Inconceivable is the beginning of this samsara. Not to be discovered is the first beginning of being, who, obstructed by ignorance and ensnared by craving, are hurrying and hastening through this round of rebirth. Thus, you have long undergone suffering, undergone torment, undergone misfortune, and filled the graveyard full, truly, long enough to be dissatisfied with all the forms of existence. Long enough to turn away and free yourselves from them all. This is the big picture. In a way of looking at this notion of samsara in the moment, it means this feeling of always moving on to the next thing, sometimes called perpetual wandering. In the cosmology of Buddhism, in the time scale of India, it's seen as an endless cycle of birth and death, becoming, existence, death and rebirth. Maybe we have a feeling for that, maybe not. But in some ways we can just allow that perception to resonate. I think it's valuable because in a way it allows us to resonate with the perception of something that's mysterious. We can't really, you know, if we look from an individual point of view, we say, well, I don't really know if this is true or not. But if we look from a bigger point of view, if we look up into the cosmos, into the stars at night, into the sky, and see how vast actually this universe is, how huge it is, how mysterious it is, then it's not so far-fetched. Or we could at least say we don't know. Maybe it's the case that we've been involved in these endless rounds of birth and death. We don't remember, perhaps. But enough, the Buddha said, even in this lifetime, how much is enough to begin the journey of really beginning to sense? Is there anything beyond this endless feeling of becoming, seeking, searching for something that we haven't got yet? And so in this feeling that can give rise to the experience in the original Pali language called nibbida, which means a sort of a weariness, a world weariness. It's a sort of disenchantment, a feeling of not being so enchanted anymore with the sights and the sounds and the possibilities and the aims and the projects. Not to say that those aren't important or valuable, But eventually the feeling, is there anything else? Is there any place that I can turn to, that I can acknowledge, that I can know? And so this is the teaching of the Four Noble Truths, in many ways, is to try and turn the mind, to first of all bring the mind to know, to really feel the limitations of trying to grasp and hold, of trying to find eternal pleasure, to recognize the inherent impermanence and unsatisfactoriness. It's the mind, the heart really needs to know that before it can sometimes feel this sense of nibbida, of weariness, and then turn, the mind to turn to find a different kind of journey, rather than a journey of perpetual wandering and seeking and looking, the journey towards, is there any release, is there any home, is there any way to transcend? So in his formulation, he very much used what was originally a structure that was originally used by the physicians, the medics of ancient India, the Ayurvedic system of medicine. So the Buddha had this way of using what was already there to model his teachings on. The four aspects of Ayurvedic medicine is to first of all name the disease, to recognize there's a disease, and then to look at the cause, where does it come from, then to look, is there a cure, to find the cure, and then the remedy to bring about the cure. And in the same model he placed his Four Noble Truths, the dis-ease. And his articulation was that in this round of samsara, in this round of becoming, there is this experience in this human realm that we all have called dukkha. And there's different translations. Sometimes it means a wheel that's out of alignment. It doesn't roll, it's not harmonious. Something that's constantly this sort of jagged experience of dukkha. It can mean, du means apart from, akash means the spacious, or the whole, or the perfect. That's this feeling of not being perfect or whole. This dis-ease that we carry as human beings, that we feel not at home. It's this unsatisfactoriness that we have. It can be quite subtle. It can be quite nameless, quite formless even. We can't even name what it is, but this sense of not never being quite at peace, and that's why it's called a dis-ease, a lack of ease. The Buddha went on to say that there is this experience of dukkha, that birth is dukkha, coming into form is dukkha. When a baby is born, we all go gaga, doo-doo, lovely, wonderful, lovely to have. For us, it's beautiful to have the birth of a baby. We can't, most of us, unless we go into regressions, and then people I've spoken to that have remembered their birth, it's often a very, very traumatic experience, coming in a very vulnerable form, very dependent, coming into life. One teacher said, we think that death is loneliness, but it's nothing compared to the loneliness of birth. This experience of beginning, uncertain, vulnerable, birth is dukkha, old age, these are the more obvious ones, old age is dukkha, the feeling of aging, the loss of power that we might have when we're younger, the loss of vigor. I notice that getting into my middle years, the memory not working so well, or less ability to have so much strength. you know, society aging is not something we respect that much, very much. Perhaps here, I don't know, but in many of our modern societies, it's people that are aged, relegated, pushed out. They're not interesting anymore to us. They're not powerful to us. They're not sexually attractive to us. There's this feeling of being, there's a fear of aging. It's not something that we honor anymore. It's something that, it's almost something wrong. Quickly go get a facelift because I'm beginning to naturally wrinkle up. What happens? Or go and shift something quick. Stay as young as we can for as long as we can. So this natural process for us is something that tends to, if we don't really have much wisdom, can bring a lot of suffering. There's a nice story of Ramdas, which I like very much. He's a wonderful teacher. And I can't remember if it's his book on aging or it's a CD, I heard it, but he talks about, there's an old man walking down the road, and as he's walking he hears this sound. And he looks down and there's this frog going, pick me up. So he looks and he picks up the frog, and the frog goes to him, I'm really a beautiful princess, and if you kiss me, I'll turn into this gorgeous maiden, and I'll cook for you, and I'll look after you, and I'll keep your bed warm at night. He looks at the frog, and he puts it in his pocket, and carries on walking, and a bit later the frog goes, Did you hear me? And he looks down and he says, at this time of my life, I think it's more interesting to have a talking frog. We have to be content with talking frogs as we get older. But it's also a time when we can, allow, it's the journey beginning towards home. It's the journey towards the getting off the train, as one great saint said. We've done our work, the journey towards beginning to let go. In our society, the message we get is, we shouldn't let go, we just keep perpetuating as much youth as we can. And so this experience, if it's not handled well, can be very difficult for us, very conflicted, and yet naturally allowing the process of letting go. Birth is dukkha, aging is dukkha, sickness, ill health, we're all susceptible. None of us are going to experience a lifetime without that. And again, these can be doorways. They're dukkha when we don't really accept or open or negotiate or find a way of working, engaging that process. When we resist it, and when we idealize how we think our life should be, then it's dukkha. Not getting what we want. Perpetual state of not getting what we want or getting what we don't want. Being with the unloved, being parted from the loved. All of these are very human experiences. Even the five focuses of the grasping mind, as we chanted in the morning, the focuses of the grasping mind, that which we call ourselves, rupa, the body, vedana, the feeling, sanya, the perception, sankara, the patterns, the feeling tones, the memories of me, the sense of me, vijnana, the moments of how we know, consciousness, that arises at the sense doors. It's consciousness that's actually like a momentary happening at the sense doors, a thought, a feeling, a sight, a sound, like electricity. It's arising, giving a sense of knowing. continuity. All of this, the Buddha said, is dukkha because it's undependable. Another translation of dukkha is it's undependable. It's in a state of flux. And yet trying to build a home there, trying to find solidity, and not understanding the nature of change leads us into this experience of constriction. So it was laid out in this paradigm of a medical paradigm. Each of the aspects of the Four Noble Truths has a remedy. The first truth, there is this experience of dukkha. It isn't a statement, a value judgment, saying life is bad or it's all a heap of suffering. It's not that. There's just this, in a way, quite dispassionate acknowledgement. There's this experience, and the remedy is that it needs to be understood. This is in the Dhammacakka Sutta, the way it's laid out. There is this experience of dukkha, and it needs to be turned to, which is what we've been doing on our retreat. It needs to be contemplated. It needs to be reflected on. It needs to be embraced. What we tend to do with that, in that experience of unsatisfactoriness, dis-ease, dukkha arises, we tend to resist it. We tend to deny it. We tend to repress it. We tend to shift our gaze. As you noticed on a retreat, it's very hard to shift our gaze. We can't really, shift the channel like we can at home when we turn over the TV onto another channel. Here we are. This reactivity, we project it out. We project it onto the world around us. This is not right. This should be different. And it's not to say those things aren't true, but this habitual way of not really coming to terms with this core experience of unsatisfactoriness by trying to manipulate the environment to give us the sense of satisfaction that we feel we need. And as we know, we have enormous power of technology these days to control, to give us warmth when we're cold, cool when we're hot, to give us pleasing sights when we're bored. We have such a low tolerance for this experience of dukkha that we're always shifting the trying to get it right, trying to get things just right so we can alleviate this feeling of inner stress, inner dukkha. Or if we don't project it outwards, we project it inwards on the sense we create a sense of self. If I'm feeling this, there must be something wrong with me. I'm bad because I'm suffering. Why am I suffering? And so in this remedy of the first noble truth, there's this encouragement to, with a Vipassana eye, to turn to contemplate, to turn to understand, to stand with, to be with, not to solve, not to fix. As a meditator, we're not with that experience to try and fix it, to solve it, to work it out, but just to be with it, just that attention, the mindfulness that we've been with the breath, just to turn that and to feel, allow ourselves to feel, not to judge the dukkha, not to think about it, but to receive it. Receive it with the field of awareness. Ironically, the moments of being with dukkha, the moments of accepting it and not resisting it, begins to allow us to resolve the experience, begin to find a way out. So our teacher said, that which we can observe, that which we can know, we can transcend. we're not becoming it. We don't have to become it. As we start to notice in each moment, we can have philosophize around the experience of suffering, but say in this moment, as we notice the struggle in the mind, we can start to notice what gives birth to that sense. There's some dukkha, yes, there's some dukkha that we can't do much about, that's inherent in being compounded, pains in the leg, pains in the knees, aging. There's some things that are just inherent, they're just in there. But there's some, the dukkha that the Buddha is talking about that we work to alleviate is something that we're doing. We're creating the suffering from a state of ignorance. We're not victims, it's not being done to us. It's the mind's own lack of insight that's generating this perpetual state of struggle. So as we start to recognize in this moment there's dukkha, we can look what's generating it. And so the Buddha pointed then in the Second Noble Truth to the causes, to look what causes the sense of that which generates in each moment in our relationship to this moment, this experience of dukkha. Part of it is that the heart or the mind, not knowing its own nature as primordial awareness, not knowing awareness of its own nature, spacious awareness, not really knowing that, there's this tendency to feel a sense of self that arises dependent on a thought, dependent on feeling, dependent on a habit or memory. That sense of self needs to be maintained, satisfied, find placement. And so this movement, in a way, the movement away from that very core of just knowing how it is in this moment, just knowing, the refuge of awareness of knowing, the movement into the Buddha called it tanha, the search that we were looking at this morning, it's one of the hindrances, the movement into wanting, thirsting for becoming something other than what's here. The thirsting for finding something to complete us through the sensory contact. So the two main forces of tanha or thirsting or craving is this wanting to become something and wanting to find fullness through eye, the sensory contact of the eye, through the right sound, through the right feeling, through the right touch. And as we contemplate the nature of this tanha or this thirsting, this wanting and this not wanting, is never stated. It always, the delusion of it is always like, if I just have this, then it will be enough. Sometimes it's like the child in the toy store. If I just get the right toy, I promise I won't ask for another one. And we know that. It's a very profound energy. I remember when I was living as a monastic, as a nun, and contemplating, get to really the life very free of distraction. We start to contemplate these energies, experience of dukkha, the tanha, the craving, without really being able to fulfill them. And I was contemplating very much the sexual energy, how powerful it is, how strong it is. And being a celibate life, when there's lots of opportunity to explore contemplation of that. And one day, as a young nun, I was making a fire. And we were cleaning up the monastery. We just moved in and it was full of debris. And we were getting logs and debris and burning. And I had this feeling, it's like that lusting, that craving, that thirsting for completion is a bit like the fire. And it's almost as many logs as you put on, you feel if I put this log on, it will consume it and sate it. It will put it out. But actually, the delusion of that energy is that however much you put on the fire, it just keeps blazing, it just keeps going. And it's not a judgment value about sexuality or about desire. It's just that the unconscious relationship to it keeps this sense of momentum, keeps this sense of never being satisfied. And so at some point one has to come to terms with that energy, to really to see it and not to follow it. And so the Buddha said this, this second noble truth, this, the remedy for the craving of the mind, the thirsting of the mind, the becoming, the ceaseless looking for something more than is already here, the wanting of something that's not here, or the opposite, when we've had enough, when we've been sated enough, the feeling of not wanting to exist, to not want to be embodied, to not want to be here, the sense of aversion that can come up in the mind. So these forces need to be let go of, to be let be, not to be grasped. It's not that those energies are wrong. Eventually we can purify and transform them and use those energies, but it's the unconscious relationship, the way the sense of self is shaped, that in the letting go of those, the letting be, the not following them, and we can feel even a little desire. I want to go and have a cup of tea. You see that rise, you can see it pass. And as it passes, in the passing, the not following, the not moving on the energy of becoming, you start to notice something that remains, something that's peaceful, something that's unmoving. The heart itself, that which is just aware, within which all appears and dissolves. We don't really, we miss that heart, we miss that awareness when we're constantly being moved by the force of tanha. We moved on to the next thing, or pushing away what's here. Hence the skill, the meditative skill to really accurately be present enough to really notice how is it now. The problem is not necessarily in the pain, or the difficulty, or the disturbance, or the lack of peacefulness in the mind. The problem is really in the aversion to what's here, or the wanting something else that isn't here. And so when we have moments of relinquishing, that then the third noble truth becomes revealed. It's more subtle insight called Nirodha. Nirodha means a cessation, the mind not grasping, the heart not grasping at anything, not needing to find a definition, not needing to describe ourselves in any way to any thought form, not needing to find permanence in a world of change, but actually being willing to allow the heart to recognize its own nature, the awareness to recognize its own presence when it's not needing anything and not pushing anything away. So this third noble truth, the Buddha said, needs to be realized, Nirodha, which leads to the non, it literally means cessation of grasping or non-clinging, which leads to this taste of Nibbana, the taste of that which is peaceful, which can only be here and now, not in some future mansion of our ideal meditation retreat. There's no ideal meditation retreat. There's no ideal teacher. There's no ideal teaching. It's all of it, you know, as it is. It's here and now. It can only be here and now. This realization can only really appear for us when the heart is not grasping at anything, when the mind is not grasping, and it's not rejecting, not pushing away. So sometimes this third noble truth is called. It's likened to a certain sort of dispassion or disenchantment or cooling. Or peaceful. There's still the karmic force operating, there's still thought, there's still feeling, there's still memory, there's still stuff happening, there's still the day, there's still the night, there's still the coming, the going, the wanting, the not wanting, it's all happening, but there's no grasping, there's no identification. And when there's no identification, then we realize that we've always been here. The samsara, the eons, the cosmos, the stars, the the sense of self, the thought from the subtlest thought form to the cosmological unfolding, the great heavens, the great galaxies, the empires, the perceptions of ourselves, the relationships, the love, the hate, the birth, the death, comings, the going, the season. It's all unfolding within this unchanging space of the heart. It's not going anywhere. Just needing to be realized, just needing to be turned to, just needing to be open to be noticed. So the third noble truth called sometimes the other shore, or the place of non-struggle, the place of non-suffering, and it appears right with the suffering. It's right when there's a moment of, so suffering can become the doorway, rather than being an enormous drag, something wrong with me, something wrong with the world, it becomes a doorway, it becomes an invitation, when we can pick it up and contemplate it according to wisdom. And this is the fourth noble truth, is the way of contemplation. The heart that's able to contemplate is the heart that's mindful, that's present. This is the path, the notion of path. In essence, the path is the way of mindfulness, moment by moment. I haven't quite finished. I'm nearly finished, not quite. I want to spend some time on this teaching tonight because it is such a beautiful teaching. It is such, it's a teaching that the Buddha didn't teach for, he taught for human beings. You know, when he first expressed his enlightenment, the first teaching he gave was to someone that came up to him and said, "Boy, you're amazingly radiant. You're so beautiful. Who are you? What are you about?" And the Buddha just said, "I'm the All Enlightened One. I'm the World Transcender." It's the statement of what we are. When we know, it's not an ego statement, it's what we are, when we know our true being. But the guy couldn't get it. There's no way, nothing to hold on to. So that's the most truthful statement. We are already enlightened. There's already enlightenment. We just don't realize it. So he tried to communicate that, but it wasn't, the person couldn't grasp it. So he said, "Nice for you. See you next time around." So the formulation of the Four Noble Truths is very skillful. Instead of saying there is enlightenment, which we can then create all sorts of ideals and hopes and fantasies about, the Buddha's approach is there is suffering. It's something we all, every day, we suffer. And there's nothing to be ashamed about, nothing to take personally as a failing. It's our experience, all of us. But to see it as an opportunity to open to contemplate, to be mindful with, to explore, to look in each moment as we approach. Where's the identification, where's the grasping, to let go little by little, not in one big blast. Sometimes we think enlightenment means one big, you know, rocket ship taking off, leaving the earth, never coming back. It's a moment by moment releasing. And some of that releasing happens organically. Kirisa was saying in the dialogue this afternoon about being the feeling of being imprisoned, where's the escape? And Ajahn Chah saying 70% of our work is to know we're imprisoned, to feel that tension, feel the grasping, feel the tension of it. That's 30% of the letting go, of the opening, that's organic. It's not necessarily an act of will. It's something we do a little bit and a little bit and a little bit and allow ourselves to trust. There's a territory between the second and third noble truth. As we start to let go, we don't always know what we're letting go into. And, we've been used to having reference points structured on our thoughts, on our memories, on our habits, on our ambitions, on where we're going. As we start to let go, there's another territory that opens up. Maybe we get dislocated, or we get fearful or anxious. It can happen in meditation for a lot of people. Start to let go, and suddenly we're not quite sure of the territory anymore. Who am I? Where am I going? How do I live? It's disorientation. And this is natural, this is normal. It's something that we need to negotiate, not to move out of and recontract. It's not something going wrong, it's actually meant to happen. The movement from the second to the third noble truth isn't just one movement, it's a process. It happens over time. Until we have moments of trusting, being just being here and now and awareness is enough. And then we feel, it's not enough, I need to... Or we can feel a lot of anxiety coming up. Don't know who I am anymore. that's a good sign. I remember when I was practicing in the monastery, I would get a lot of terror that would come up. And being particularly youthful and idealistic, my approach to it was I should create even more so that I can really break through and put myself in a position where there'd be even more fear, so I can really challenge that fear and break through it and crash through into the great sublime void oneness on the other side. I know fear is just a barrier, and on the other side it's bliss, and I just need to crash through that wall. And so I was going to go out into the forest, sit by myself in the middle of the night. I knew that would do it. And a little bit of wisdom said, you should check in with your teacher before. You know, just check in and mention your plan, your enlightenment plan. It might be a good idea. So I went to Ajahn Sumedho with my teacher and said, Bhante, I've got this plan. I'm going to go out to the side. I've got to crash through it. You know, I'm just going to bring it all up and take it on. He said, I wouldn't do that if I was you. I wouldn't do that. And he said something that was very helpful. He said, you know, these things, they drop away in their own time. You know, they have their own way of dropping away. You don't have to go and force the issue. In fact, not very wise, usually, to force the issue. You know, just meet it as it comes up. Meet it as it comes up. So if there's anxiety comes up, we just meet it. We start to have faith rather than in creating constructs of the mind to hang on to, thought forms, perceptions, memories, doubts. We start to have confidence in moments of mindfulness, the past activity. And that's the work that we can do. It's the only work we can really do in each moment. Well, there's other things. A bit categorical to say that, but it's an essential aspect of the work that we can do is just to meet how it is with the mindfulness, with the presence, with the attention, and to trust that. So we're learning to trust in that territory between the second and third noble truth. We're learning to trust the awareness to do the work. We're learning to trust, as my teacher said, he said, you know, after 30, 40 years of being a monk, reading all the books, the suttas, doing so many practices, ascetic practices, everything in the book you can think of, it boils down to trusting in awareness in this moment. It's that much, that little. And so it's learning to allow that to do the work of liberation. Not, I can't do it. The I can't do it. And I was, a young nun full of vigor. And this feeling of I've got to get enlightened. It became such a burden. It became such a huge, mammoth task. And I actually got exhausted just by the idea of it. And I remember one day just laying down in this field outside of the monastery and feeling, I can't do it anymore. I can't do it, so I'm just going to die. I'm just going to lay here and die. Well, you know, there's only so long you can lay dying before you have to get up. And it was a good moment for me as I realized, you know, the I can't do it. It's something that's going to happen in and of itself. And so the putting down of that extra stress, I've got to sort this out, I've got to, you know, realize peace, I've got to, what we can do is just keep having confidence that as we meet the moments of our experience with investigation and mindfulness, the process of liberation begins to operate in and of itself. And at that point, the you know, wonderful Chinese master said that it's no longer suffering, but you know, when the relationship from the place of awareness and mindfulness is no longer generating suffering in the world from the misinterpretation of life, the misidentification of self with the changing forms of life, the misinterpretation, making assumptions that it's more stable than it is, the demand that we have that the mortal is immortal. And when we have a relationship of reality, then rather than generating the perpetual struggle and suffering, the Chinese master said it becomes wonderful existence. The suffering becomes wonderful existence. But in fact, we're involved in something that's very beautiful, very mysterious. In each moment, if we can meet it as that. Beautiful poem that was there in Jerusalem to finish our evening reflection. Dominique Tarr. Having loved enough and lost enough, I'm no longer searching, just opening. No longer trying to make sense of pain, but trying to be a soft and sturdy home in which real things can land. These are the irritations that rub into a pearl. So we can talk for a while, but then we must listen. The way rocks listen to the sea. And we can churn at all that goes wrong, but then we must lay all distractions down and water every living seed. And yes, on nights like tonight, I too feel alone, but seldom do I face it squarely enough to see that it's a door into the endless breath that has no breather.